Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Michael Rucker, Chief Digital Officer at Active Wellness, and another member of the HIMSS Digital Influencer Program. So this is yet another in the series of my talks with my fellow program members. So Michael, welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what I always like to do before really getting into the main part of the discussion is to let my guests provide more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So Michael, the floor is yours.
I appreciate that. Yeah. So my day job is the chief digital officer for Active Wellness. We primarily manage fitness and wellness offerings in various installations. So a big bulk of our corpus is in corporate campuses, but we're also doing a lot of work now in residential centers as a tenant amenity, and then also putting these facilities in hospitals so that, we're delivering medically appropriate fitness modalities. So my role in that is coalescing all of the technology that makes those systems operate from, the member management systems at the front desk all the way to IoT devices that track intervention efficacy and things of that nature. So it's really fun because I'm an entrepreneur at heart. And so to be able to always do something different at any given installation, I really have passion for that work. And then my side hustle is I'm working on a book on the science of fun. It's sort of a reframe of a lot of the traditional ideas brought forth by positive psychology. So I have a PhD in organizational psychology. So that effort is allowing me to keep my saw sharp in that area as well. So those are my two passions, including my family, my two kids, and my wife. So kind of have three pillars that are supporting me right now.
Yeah, no, and I'm sure all three are keeping you more than busy and more active than you might anticipate.
I love it, though. I love it.
Kind of, I'm intrigued about your description about the wellness activities and installing facilities, and it sounds like really, kind of most places where people might want to interact with them. So I'm kind of intrigued to know, how do you define wellness?
Yeah, so I don't know that I do. I do in the sense that you would define obesity, right? So wellness is this construct that can be used as an indicator of, subjectively how you feel, right? In writing the book about fun, I've also been looking at happiness in sort of the same way, right? Happiness is the subjective measure that is a word that we define so that we can kind of all agree on a term, right, about this subjective state that we have. And to some degree, wellness transcends the complexity of even something like happiness. And that's why actually in the last couple of years, you've seen people sort of move away from that word to this idea of well-being, sort of this reframe of what wellness is, because if you look at different paradigms of people trying to describe it, they'll add all sorts of different attributes, right? In fact, so much so, and this is actually a thought in real time, is, the culmination of social determinants of health that we've talked about so much in our cohort, right? And the importance of that. So it's the coalesce of these ideas of how you feel about yourself, whether that's physical, mental. Right now, we're talking a lot about financial, right? Because that's certainly a big stressor of millennials. And so it really encompasses a lot of things. And because it's complex, oftentimes it's confusing, right? So again, I'm confessing to you, you asked me what is wellness exactly, there's not a discrete answer, but at the end of the day, it's a subjective measure of how you're doing. And to the extent that we can play a part, especially on the fitness side of improving, physical well-being, that's the role that Active Wellness plays.
And that description really sounds, more kind of embedded in an individual's lifestyle and, just as you said, overall perception of their own feeling about themselves, as opposed to maybe the way wellness has been pushed in the past few years, which is seems to be more around, you know, kind of employer-sponsored wellness programs that are starting to show inconsistent results.
Yeah, and so let's be careful there, because certainly I am, you know, I like listening to all positions on that. So as much as I like, you know, the information coming out from Wellcoa and Hero, I also respect gentlemen like Al Lewis, that's sort of the counterpoint, right? And so I think one thing that I would agree on, because I do believe in empirical data, is that lifestyle interventions tend to fall flat, right? And I think if you look at longitudinal data, you can see why. At the end of the day, an inconvenient truth for the fitness industry is that in any given population, only 20 to 40% of people want a gate to engage in fitness. And for the most part, these workplace wellness interventions are things like co-opetitions or step challenges, you know, things of that nature that really require you to get active as, you know, the prescription for wellness, right? And so that can be debated which is going to work, but any given, like if you look at a pharmaceutical intervention, right, even like beta blockers and things that have a high level of efficacy, it's still only a percentage of people that, you know, it has a positive effect. And that's why things like personalization and medicine is such a big deal right now, right? Yet the onus on lifestyle intervention, we're really trying to affect 100% of the population. So it's really interesting in context when people are trying to evaluate these, that they're using, you know, measures where, well, okay, we're only reaching like 30% of any given employee population. And if it's a sort of passive intervention, something like Virgin Pulse, you know, the numbers are lower. Well, that's because you're asking this employee population to, you know, consume something that might not be in line with their identity. And so, again, in this evolution of kind of the marketing construct of what wellness or well-being is, you're now seeing people redefine it, right? So does that mean that you have an acupuncturist on site? Does that mean, you know, is engaging in massage, which is a form of recovery, which arguably is a part of wellness, you know, should that be encompassed in sort of the way we look at this? Now, the problem is every time you add an element, then how do you measure its efficacy, right? Like, if you're broadening the spectrum of wellness, which you certainly are seeing, you know, in these analyst reports where they're adding things like salons and spas, you know, into, oh, the, you know, wellness market is increasing by 18%. And you're seeing it's actually because the industry definition is expanding. You know, it's where do you put that stake in the ground? So to answer your question discreetly, from what I've seen, you're correct. Lifestyle interventions don't seem to have an impact on health costs in a very short duration. So, you know, with a 1 year span, there's just not too much evidence to suggest it. Now, if individuals can opt into condition specific programs, and that's where we get into data privacy issues and things of that nature. But if there is some way to identify the people that are at risk interventions have huge efficacy. So then it, again, that becomes an interesting part of the equation, right? Because folks like, or, you know, I'm not going to put anyone on blast, but people that are super critical of these programs are kind of talking, you know, they are using the fact that lifestyle interventions have, you know, are kind of net neutral. And at the same time, then they'll say that data privacy issues negate, you know, our ability to deliver these condition-specific protocols that have actually been shown to have a huge impact. And so what do you do there, right? At the end of the day, I think our position is that you add it as an employee amenity because there are things that we can measure. For instance, for a fitness facility, if your fitness facility is 50 feet away from your desk or requires you to drive 5 miles away from, you know, to deviate 5 miles from your commute home, you're more likely to consume fitness, you know, using some of BJ Fogg's algorithms, right? Because you're reducing, you're taking away that environmental load and you're increasing motivation. So I think that argument, although one might say you're catering to people that are highly motivated, you're still increasing, you know, their opportunities and you're positively influencing these social determinants of health in a positive way.
Right. And even if there is an argument, you know, kind of, as you just said, that you might be catering towards, you know, an already motivated population, that doesn't seem like that should be an argument against it. I mean, it really, I think kind of implicit in what you're saying is you have to look broadly and, we have to be adaptable and think about how can we evolve strategies so that we can meet each individual need as opposed to trying to impose a standard on everybody.
Yeah, and that's where I get kind of caught in the middle, right? Because as an academic, but then also obviously as an enthusiast of the space, from an academic standpoint, absolutely, most of these studies have been designed for selection bias, right? Because you look at one group that has opted in for some sort of wellness modality, so you know that they're already probably to some significant degree more motivated than the general population. And so, you know, finally, there have been a couple of double blinds, and that's okay, right? From an academic standpoint, you need to think about those constructs. To your point, there are greater good arguments that why wouldn't you do this? Why wouldn't you provide this type of offering? And I posit, because now we're seeing studies that have more longitudinal data, that there are softer measures like social cohesion and the ability to change company culture, that over time, as there are things that you need to do above just offering it as an amenity, like getting leadership involved and changing company culture and things that are a little bit harder, you know, than just buying fitness equipment. But over time, those are showing an effect, you know, that's just harder to measure. So,
yeah. And it seems like a kind of a consistent theme of what you're talking about is time, and that we need to be thinking with a longer view as opposed to just short, immediate returns.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think you need to figure out what's working, right? So I know we're going to get into it potentially a little bit later, but my doctoral work was looking specifically at SMBs that are getting it right. And I think if you have the ability to look at your company culture and devise interventions that are specific to the needs of that culture, rather than prescribing to whatever vendor is selling you, you have a much better chance of success. So for instance, one of the companies that I studied as a doctoral student realized that they just weren't going to get their employees to stop smoking, because this was a company that had a lot of developers on site, and smoking was part of the culture. So they bought into the smoking cessation program, which actually has one of the highest efficacies of most wellness interventions, ironically, but they just knew this group wasn't going to stop smoking. And so they use that money for more effective measures because, you know, again, at the population level, that would have been the safest bet. But at the population level of this specific company, they were smart enough to know that it wouldn't. And so they used those dollars in other ways that were more impactful.
And that's actually really interesting because it's, as you said, it's recognizing what you know is changeable and what is not changeable at the same time. And, you know, if you know something isn't going, you're not going to be able to move the needle on something, why try and force it? Because arguably that could undermine the culture of your workplace or other kind of cohort that you're looking at. And then, as you said, you can then find areas where you can actually more effectively spend your money and drive positive change.
Yep, agree, absolutely. And then I believe in the power of small wins, right? So, you know, especially at the onset of these initiatives, if you set yourself up for failure, it's often going to just not continue, which I certainly saw empirically in, you know, while I was acquiring data for my literature review of people that had abandoned programs because of early losses. So if you can get that momentum, and actually maybe I should do a follow-up study, I would imagine, you know, now that they've gotten this employee population healthy in ways that identified, you know, with the culture of that particular organization, they might be able to revisit things that are more provocative.
Yeah. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Michael Rucker from Active Wellness, and we've been talking about different interpretations and viewpoints on wellness and how a program or, you know, interventions can be viewed as effective. And Michael, I'd kind of like to pivot a little bit right now and go back to one of the other topics that you mentioned at the start, although maybe it does build off of what we've been talking about, and it's your other passion area of on having fun. So can you give us a little bit more of a background in terms of what you've been researching and what you focus on, and then how that maybe builds upon how you can implement effective programs?
Yeah, I appreciate that. So it is a little bit different, but certainly as I've gotten a rich understanding of the material, it is bleeding into my day job, as it should. I think one of the books that I'm really enjoying right now is BJ Fogg's new book, and this idea that, you know, improving motivation can certainly be done through pleasurable experiences, which is in line with fun. So I certainly think a lot of wellness interventions that are made to be more enjoyable will see better prosperity. But for me specifically, 3 years ago, my younger brother died unexpectedly of a pulmonary embolism. And I've been a big fan of positive psychology for quite some time. I'm a charter member of the IPPA. And so I have all of these academic tools of happiness. And when my brother passed away, I just couldn't will myself to be happy. And so I was sort of in this interesting space. And it was also during the time of my doctoral work of, okay, I don't get it. You know, like I, granted I'm allowed to be sad, but I can't really get myself out of despair. And I was wondering why. So being a good academic, I went to the research and saw that there was a huge, you know, obviously a ton of information about various applications of subjective happiness and how to influence that, but not a lot about this action-oriented concept of having fun. So I started doing some self-experimentation as well as digging into the limited amount of research that was there. And there's a lot of power in fun as, you know, sort of this reframe that it's okay at times to not necessarily need to pursue, you know, some absolute, that we have agency, even in times where we're struggling in other areas, to go out and have a good time. And so I found that as sort of this, you know, again, a shift away from, you know, trying to be overly optimized to, you know, being okay with looking at life as separate buckets and making sure that instead of viewing happiness as a subjective construct, I was actually taking action. And then what was more profound after, you know, kind of gaining some mastery in the subject is that you have agency about having a good time and you can feel good and at the same time coexist when things aren't necessarily going well. Because a little bit later, I used to do Ironmans in my previous life. And around that time, I also found out that I had advanced osteoarthritis. It hit me like within 3 months. I went from, you know, getting a PR in a half marathon to basically being told that I would never run again. And so it was kind of a 1-2 punch, and but a great period for, you know, self-exploration, because it just, you know, I wasn't happy, but that was okay. And now I found, you know, especially in today's society, you know, with the burnout rates that we're seeing, and then, you know, millennials with epidemic loneliness, that a lot of people have lost sight that they have agency to live a good life, and that it's okay to feel other things. And at the same time, make sure that you sort of index these opportunities for pleasure so that you don't lose your mind.
With that concept of opportunities for pleasure, you know, how do you go about promoting and becoming more self-aware to take advantage of the opportunities?
So the simplest thing that I prescribe, and it might be because I'm a quant geek, but it seems to be helpful for the entire spectrum of folks, is just to take a simple time audit. You know, there's only 168 hours in our week, and it's pretty easy to do. I fell upon this idea myself because, you know, in my industry, nutrition journals are often prescribed. But then I found out that, you know, this is kind of a common idea of folks that write about productivity. But, you know, again, it's not that hard, especially because most of us should be sleeping, you know, at least 56 hours. So if you minus 56 from 168, there's not a lot of things that we need to log. And there is an immense amount of an awareness from that exercise. And then what I prescribe is a simple 4-quadrant model. You know, folks that have PhDs often know those are simple tools, but a lot of folks outside of academia don't realize the power of that. And I call it the play model. And you really look for opportunities, you know, within your 168 hours that are sort of either dead time that you weren't, you know, aware that you're kind of just, you know, wasting that away, or opportunities that you could do something a little bit better that might bring you more pleasure. So an anecdote that I often like to share is when I did an audit on my own time, I realized that I was spending time on the weekends just watching my young daughter dance. So I'd sit there on my phone. It wasn't pleasurable at all. You know, I obviously got enjoyment watching my daughter towards a path of mastery, but it was very episodic pleasure and it was unengaging for me. And she's young enough. She's only 7. that I realized, you know what, dancing's kind of fun. And it's not like she's excelling to the point where she needs, you know, expert coaching. Like, I could take this class with her for probably $10 extra a session. We could just get private lessons and we could do this together while she learns her skills. I could have fun with her and at the same time, you know, create bond and memories and things that I could savor and relish later. And so that simple shift, as simple as it sounds, you know, now we're having an amazing time together. And that hour that before was probably not memorable, you know, 2 years from now, I'm never going to forget this, you know?
No, and I think that anecdote is really impactful because it's, you know, kind of mirrors what I was already starting to think as you were describing it, which is, you know, this is probably targeted to the segment of the population that has children, but I find, you know, because I have two young kids too, and I find that they help to push you in a direction of called living in the moment where they're just concerned with doing what to them looks to be fun or, you know, has them playing and not worried about broader concerns. And, you know, it's nice to engage with them in that way and kind of adopt their viewpoint.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And at the same time, there's wisdom there, right? Because another sort of key concept, and now we're getting into headier topics, and I know, you know, our time is short, but another thing that you can learn from kids that's valuable is the fact that their aspirations are untethered. So, you know, one of the drawbacks, like of anything good, anything, you know, too much of anything good generally starts to turn bad, right? So fun and pleasure can certainly be used for escapism. And unfortunately, my four-year-old is kind of going through a Skinner box type situation right now where, you know, because I've optimized all of our lives for fun, he's kind of always looking for the next adventure. And so I think as adults, it's really, you know, taking that audit that you've had and making sure that you're deliberate about what you're looking for, you know, truly understanding what brings you pleasure. Is it scrolling through Instagram or is it something within there that you've been searching for quite some time that you can actually engage in, right? And then also understanding and valuing those opportunities for fun and looking back at them and relishing them and savoring them and understanding that they're a part of your life, but not all consuming. So I love, you know, basking in the innocence of children. But at the same time, when you see a child sort of throw a tantrum because it's time to go, that's also another great lesson for adults, right? Is that we kind of suffer that same fate, but in a different way. If anything is untethered, right? Whether that's pursuit, again, you know, what I found about happiness where I was like, okay, well, where's the finish line? But there isn't really one, or a whole host of, you know, different ailments that we all suffer from time to time.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting observation. Hopefully I'm interpreting this correctly, but it sounds like a lot of it comes down to balance and, you know, always trying to tread that fine line because it's, you know, as you said, too much of a good thing can become bad, but it seems like also on the flip side, if you're not taking enough time and attention to get to the good, you're kind of wallowing in the bad a little too much.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, with more time, we would nuance the problems of defining it as work-life balance, especially now where there is no distinction between work and life. So I think once you understand that, then balance does become a helpful construct again. But, you know, again, that's why it's important to look at your entire week, because I think, you know, in the previous iteration, you know, productivity 1.0 and things of that nature, we were trying to delineate the break, right? A common dictum would be, you know, make sure your phone is turned off when you get home and things of that nature. And similar to fitness not working for everyone, it's clear, you alluded to it earlier, that if advice is never going to be listened to, then we need to find better advice, right? Or different interventions. And so this idea that, you know, especially information workers can break from their jobs is just proving not to be accurate. So we need better tools. And so again, you know, finding fun within your environment, finding fun within your family life, but understanding that that's going to be peppered throughout your week. And it's not like you can completely time block one thing from the next. Is an important part of the process as well.
Yeah, no, I think that point that just with modern life, and maybe this was always true, that, you know, all aspects of your life are always intermixed. It's, you know, very rare to be able to say, okay, I've got X chunk of time is devoted completely to, you know, one thing, and then when the clock hits a particular time, you completely flip over to another thing. There's always, you know, different aspects of your life coming together.
Yep, that's exactly right. And it's okay to take breaks, right? I'm a big fan of Cal Newport's work, and I believe in deep work, and I absolutely believe that you should shut down the rest of the world when you're with people that you love, because they deserve your attention. You know, if we want to get into the nuances of the neuroscience, you know, we keep talking about dopamine, but not enough people are talking about oxytocin, which gets released when you look into someone who you love's eyes. You know, so this idea that we can kind of keep up with people through social media has just proven not to be true, because although we think we feel good at the end of the day, we don't, you know, have all that we need from those types of experiences. So there should be times that you're deliberate about what you're doing in that moment. But the idea that you can completely delineate certain things has just proven not to be true.
No, I think that's a good point. And believe it or not, we're already very close to the end of our time. So I'd like to pose one final question to you, which is, if you could offer one piece of advice, what would you offer in terms of how people can introduce more fun into their lives?
So I think taking that time audit is the best step. You know, ultimately looking for opportunities where you can either bundle fun experiences and within things that have become habitual, but are ripe for improvement. And that's the best way, you know. And then, you know, the second step, oftentimes people find it a lot easier to offload things that they think are their responsibility or have a sense of duty for. But after even just, you know, a kind of second level of observation, realize that that's not true. One of the ones for my wife and I, and again, this is a personal anecdote, but was for some reason, our children really didn't enjoy bath time. I think it's because we tried to do it expeditiously and sort of were drill sergeants about it and didn't make it fun. But at the same time, it took time away from all of us, right? So it was a reduction in everyone's pleasure. And so we're not at a place where we could afford a full-time nanny, but we realized within our economic means, we could certainly bring in someone part-time. And so 3 days a week, and you know, for only 9 hours, we have someone come in and help us do that particular chore while we go out and spend some time together and reconnect. And so that's only 9 hours out of the 168. But it was one where we felt, you know, initially like, wow, that's kind of strange, you know, to outsource that to someone else. Wait a second, it's not that strange. You know, people at a higher economic echelon do it all the time. Why don't we do it part-time and enjoy some of the fruits of that, because we wouldn't want to do it full-time anyways. And so that's meaningful for me, but I think with a little bit of deliberation, almost anybody's going to find the same type of anecdote where they could improve some aspect of their 168 hours.
Yes, no, I think very good food for thought to take away. And as I said, believe it or not, we are out of time already. I want to thank my guest, Michael Rucker, for a great conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me. And if you're interested in the topic of fun, please check out my book next year, The Fun Habit.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.